Today, the second psalm of the Hallel in earnest.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
If you didn't get to listen to the previous episode, might be worth your time. You don't have to in order to grasp what we're going to talk about today in Psalm 114, the second psalm of the Hallel. This part of the psalm is still early in the meal, and it's still about the Exodus. But it also includes, when we say the Exodus, we mean it broadly, also including their settling in Israel 40 years later. And so as we talked about in the previous episode, we were using this one as sort of an example to say, what are the basic evaluative tools that I use to work through the Psalms? We had a question about it. I've had a few questions about it over the years, and I've taught it before in courses about preaching or about teaching. And so we thought we would take time to talk about some of the images that are in this poem, this psalm, particularly. And so I'm not going to rehash all of that, but I do want you to just catch these reminders that we talked about tropes, and in particular, tropes invite ambiguity because they use a single term to mean more than one thing. So we talked about Juliet being the sun, you know, that kind of thing. So it provides room for ambiguity. And in this psalm in particular, the ambiguity comes most prominently, not entirely, not solely, but most prominently in the form of the names of the people or land or society. So when you say Israel or Jacob or Judah or even Jordan or Egypt, by the way. Also, we talked about motifs, looking for repeated themes or elements. And in particular, we pointed out water. It's really water and land. I didn't take time to talk about both last time, but we will today because we're actually going through the psalm. And then we talked about parallels or parallelism, and the parallels especially obvious in this psalm between verses 3 and 4 and 5 and 6, which is why, as we go through this, because, you know, you can never talk about everything, so you have to sort of select and limit and reduce what you're going to do down to a time limit. You find it hard to believe that I reduce things down to a time limit, and then this is what's left. But it's true. This is a reduction from what I would do otherwise if I were really mansplaining the psalm to you. So anyway, verses 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 we're going to put together because the pairs of verses are strongly parallel with each other, obviously strongly parallel with each other, but I think they work together to make a single point that we can sort of focus on. So we talked about that as part of the, you know, some of the tools that we use to get through a psalm. And then, and this is what we're going to be doing as we go through this psalm, but I'm not going to point it out every time. We're going to hear it in Israel's mouth, for instance, as they're about to leave home, leave Egypt, the only home they've known, for something better, their true home, you know, Canaan, you know, where God has promised them a place of covenant. But Egypt, the place they're leaving, that's the only land they've ever known. So it's not going to be easy. Then we're going to hear it in Jesus' mouth. As an example, the night before he is crucified. And remember, not only is it the night before he's crucified when he's reading this with his disciples or quoting it or singing it with his disciples, but also the next day on the cross, he himself thirsts, expresses his need for a drink on the cross, which is relevant when you're reading this psalm. And then we can put it in our mouths when we need to recall that God is our refuge also. In the good times, when it's obvious that he's our refuge, look, I'm hiding in God, everything is good. But also in the bad times, when it's obvious that we need him. And when, while we need him, it's least apparent that he's actually there. So all of that we are going to do as we're working through the psalm, as we describe needing to do. And, you know, I've read through it a bunch of times, and by the time we're going through it together now, you've read through it a few times just by hearing it as I've been reading it on the air. So we're going to read it again, and then we're going to talk about it, verses 1 and 2 together, then verses 3 through 6 together, and then verses 7 and 8. When Israel, here's the psalm, when Israel went out from Egypt, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled, Jordan turned back. The mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, like lambs? Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turns the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a spring of water. This is the poem, the entire poem. And as I pointed out last time, but I will remind you now, that last verse is just, it's so distinct from everything else in the sense of appealing to a story we haven't been talking about. Now they're out in the middle of the desert and God is turning stone into water. And we know it's still Moses and he's on the way, but they're not in the sanctuary of Judah yet. And they're not just leaving Egypt. They're out in the middle of the desert already. So why are we talking about springs of water? And it is relevant. I mean, it does happen during the Exodus and even in the book of Exodus. So it's not that big a surprise, but it's still in the context of this psalm, it sort of comes out of nowhere, but not at all out of nowhere when you realize that we said we wanted to notice the motifs, and we notice the motifs of the mountains and the seas, the water of all these varieties of kinds, and then the dry land of these different kinds, but in particular, the mountains and the hills that are named, and now the desert, and how those come together. How all the water and the dry land in the Exodus plays a part in revealing what we were supposed to learn from the Exodus and what we can carry forward as we go into the wilderness, following God wherever he leads us. You know, it's particularly helpful. It's a beautiful part of this very short psalm. So now we take the first couple of verses together, and what he describes is them gathering up to leave Egypt. So when Israel went out from Egypt, when the house of Jacob went out from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary. Israel became his dominion. I'll just remind you that in the back of our minds here, Egypt is a place that's well watered. This is the Nile Delta for them, and the name of Egypt itself sort of points to the upper and lower parts of Egypt that are defined by their relationship with the Nile. So they're thinking of Egypt the same way we would think of the word Jordan. We might be talking about the country, but we also know the Jordan River, and it's an important part of what's going on. So in this watery context, God has been providing for them, but the other thing he's been providing for them in verse 1 is a strange language, which seems like a strange thing for God to provide. But this is the point that throughout the Old Testament, and this is even referred to in 1 Corinthians 14, when we're learning about tongues, the gift of tongues, and what on earth it means, and how it's to be practiced in the church, and all of that. And I'm not going to get into all of that today. That's a whole excursion on its own in 1 Corinthians 14. I'm just making the point that that chapter about God speaking to us through strange languages or foreign tongues, that appeals to the Old Testament idea that God speaks to us with people of a strange language. And the concept is probably most clearly stated in Isaiah 28 when we realize that after, in that chapter, Isaiah 28, the one about God speaking to us precept upon precept, line upon line, you know, and so on. In that chapter, what he says, after having condemned the drunken priests and prophets, the ones who are no good, in other words, you're not listening to my word anymore. You're not listening to the words that I give you that are so simple to understand. You're being disobedient and not caring what I'm speaking. Then Isaiah 28, verse 11, "For by people of strange lips and with a foreign tongue, the Lord will speak to his people." Now, it sounds like a condemnation, and it is in some ways. It's certainly a chastisement. You're going to be held captive in this foreign land. It becomes the precursor to each captivity that they experience when they're carried into foreign lands. This is what Isaiah 28 is giving the example of. When they're carried into foreign lands by enemies that defeat them, God is saying to them, "You wouldn't listen to me in your land, so now I've allowed strangers to come into your land, take you captive, and take you back to their home where they can speak to you in a gibberish that maybe you'll listen to," which is odd that we have to hear it in a foreign tongue, but that's his point. And in the same exact way, he's been providing for them in Egypt while they are growing into the nation that he wants them to be. And obviously, what he follows that with in Isaiah 28 is the promise that he will restore them from that captivity, restore them from that land of gibberish, that land, and that's literally the idea that's conveyed by one of the words that's used about this foreign tongue, that he's going to bring them back from that and give them rest so that they can come back and actually pay attention to God in their own homeland. But they even ignore that. So the statement, for instance, in Isaiah 33, this reminder of what God is doing with this, chastising them when they're in these foreign lands: "You will see no more the insolent people, the people of an obscure speech that you cannot comprehend, stammering in a tongue that you cannot understand." He's saying to them, you won't always be there. The day will come when I'll bring you home, and I'll speak to you in my own language, and you'll know your own home. And this is the point of verse 2. That in verse 1, what they might be thinking is, oh, thank heavens we're leaving the oppression of this slavery, this bondage that we've been in. But God doesn't cause his people to wander just so they can wander. This is what God's people are throughout all of Scripture. Abraham wanders. He's the father of Israel. He's the one who, you know, the first Hebrew is how he's referred to. And from him all the way down through history, Israel has always wandered. Even when they find a homeland, someone comes in and causes them to wander again so that they have to return home. Someone is always occupying the land. And even when the comparison is made between those who follow Christ, Christians, the church, and Israel, the comparison is that the people of God are scattered abroad throughout the world, that we're wandering pilgrims in this land waiting for the home that will be ours. But that's the point, that even though throughout all of history, Israel has been depicted as wandering, they're not wandering so they can continue to wander. The whole idea is that God's people wander so they can arrive. And that's the point in verse 2. After he says in verse 1, when Israel went out from Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of a strange language, now we're set up with the clause, what's the main sentence? Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. Now, there's ambiguity here, and we're given space for ambiguity because of what we were talking about, the way metaphors work, the way tropes work with language. So the clearly, if we only read verse 1 and then follow it with verse 2, then what verse 2 is saying, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel became his dominion, what verse 2 is saying is that when Judah, the people of God, Israel, now being referred to with this metonymy of Judah, well, this one tribe is named, but I mean all of Israel, and therefore he'll say in the second part, when Israel does it, and I mean all of my people. So that Judah, in that context, and just following verse 1, Judah and Israel are the people of God, and where they settle, the sanctuary they find, is the land that they're going to go to. So when they left Egypt, they came to Judah. They came to Israel. That became the place of their sanctuary. They weren't hiding in the Nile Delta anymore. They weren't hiding in the land of Goshen, as it's referred to. They were instead in their own land. Israel became Israel's dominion. Judah became Judah's sanctuary. That's the idea. Now, just reading it down from verse 1, there's no doubt that that's what it's saying. That's the idea that we're carrying into it. But by the time we get to the end of the psalm, there is equally little doubt that what he's referring to is something different, that Judah and Israel, the names when they're mentioned, so Let me just clarify for a second, because if you're just listening to this and not necessarily looking at the passage, you might not have noticed this, that in verse 2, when it says Judah became his sanctuary, there are two references to that person, Judah and then his, right? So the pronoun. So in this case, I'm saying Judah would be a reference to the land. The proper word, Judah, would be a reference to the land. And then his, the pronoun, the reference, the possessive pronoun, would be a reference to the people. So the land of Judah became the people of Judah's sanctuary. That's the idea. But what is possible by the end of the psalm, and I think inevitable by the end of the psalm, because there are lots of times the antecedent is not clear, especially in a poem, for a possessive pronoun in this case, for his sanctuary. Whose sanctuary? Well, if it's Yahweh's sanctuary, if it's a reference to God in some way, then Judah becomes different. Judah and Israel, they could be the land of Judah because he puts his temple there, and there are all kinds of ways that you could say it, but it wouldn't have a lot of direct connection with the psalm itself. But if Judah and Israel in this case are literally the people of Judah, the people of Israel, the descendants of those two individuals, Judah and Israel, if that's the case, then in this case, if Yahweh is the his, then the people become the sanctuary of God. And that's an entirely different flavor for the psalm. And what I'm saying to you is, I think we're supposed to read it the first way when we're starting the psalm, which is a true statement about what happens to Judah and Israel. Now, it's an oversimplified statement, because the way this reads, well, you know, the day they left Egypt, they came to Israel and they just set up shop. And that's not at all what happened. They went 40 years into the wilderness. So we recognize something happened in the middle. And I think that's what God introduces in the psalm by telling us about the sea turning back and the Jordan turning back, because that represents the 40 years. When they first leave Egypt, they're pressed up against the Red Sea and they don't know where to go. And when they go into the promised land, when Judah becomes his sanctuary, they cross the Jordan River. So it's almost like a merism. You're covering the two extremes, that, you know, from the Red Sea to the Jordan River. But then the rest of it's not described at all until verse 8, the very last verse, when in the middle of the desert, God provides water for them. So you can see why I'm saying we need to keep it open. So we, as I said, we read it iteratively, and that means that we read it the first time and we hold a bunch of things in abeyance. We say, I think it might mean that. And then we figure out what it really means, but what it might also mean as we read through it again and again and learn a little bit more. Okay, so we've got verses 1 and 2 down. And the main point I would carry out of that from the people of Israel, as they think about it every time they say this at Passover, every time they have a celebratory meal with each other and they say this psalm, they're remembering that they don't wander so they can wander, that they wander so they can arrive. God's people wander so they can arrive. And that has an obvious bearing on us as well. We're not in the place we are right now, where we're in between, liminal. I'm committed to God and heaven is my home, but here I am in this world and things go wrong. And I know I've been raised from the dead, and yet I'm still facing death in this world. All of that wandering that goes on for us in this life is an invitation to look at a psalm like this and say, but I remember that God never sends his people on a journey just so they can get out into the wilderness and wander around. He sends them on their way in their journey so that they can arrive home. That's what he talks about in these first two verses. The next four verses, it's two pairs of verses, remember, so verses 3 and 4 and then verses 5 and 6. You can see how obviously matched up they are. The sea looked and fled. The Jordan turned back. So the sea looked and fled part, I'll read to you, Exodus 14, verse 29, the people of Israel. So this is their, you know, pressed against the Red Sea. The Egyptians are now chasing them because they realize what they're giving up. And Pharaoh is trying to get a little vengeance on his enemies. And so he's chasing them to the Red Sea. And they're pressed against it. The army of Egypt is on one side. The Red Sea is on the other. They don't know what they're going to do. Moses says, stand still and see the salvation of your God, you know. And all of that transpires. And what follows is the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. The important thing to remember here is, we'll come back to this at the very end, when Israel could see nothing but water, everywhere they looked, there was water. Where are we going to go? Where are we going to flee? If we go this way, if we go that way, no matter where we go, we're just going to drown in the sea. Everywhere they turn, there's water. When Israel can see nothing but water, God provides dry land. This is what he does. And he does the same thing with the Jordan River. And I'm not going to dwell on it today, but throughout all of the Old Testament, this is a theme, and it's an important message. Joshua dwells on it in his message to the people when he's about to die, and he says to them, you need to maintain your covenant with God. Remember when Abraham crossed the river? Remember when Moses crossed the Red Sea? Remember when we crossed the Jordan River? He describes all the waters they have to cross and how God provides for them when they make that crossing. And in this case, he points to the two where God miraculously parts the waters. He dries the Jordan River, remember, and they walk over into the promised land. So the same thing that happened in the Red Sea happens with the Jordan. The sea looked and fled. The Jordan turned back. Where there was water, God provided dry land. Then he describes what happens on the dry land. And these are, you know, these are the masses of land that represent all the masses of land. They're mountains that we're talking about. And so in Exodus 19, 18, remember this. So the language of the poem is, the psalm, the mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. Now, we think of that as, you know, happy skittering and, you know, seeing the videos on Twitter of little animals jumping around. But this is not a joyful thing. It's not miserable either, but it is intimidating. This is not a goat skittering around or a lamb skittering around. This is a mountain moving as if it were a lamb or a goat. That's intimidating. So Exodus 19:18 is what we're referring to because this is the Exodus that we're describing. When do the mountains shake in the Exodus? Well, Mount Sinai, right after they cross the Red Sea, they go a couple of weeks off into the wilderness, they come to Mount Sinai, and Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. When the people arrived at the landmass to represent all landmasses, a mountain, it trembled. And the language that follows really emphasizes this. Because what the people say, which is an invitation for all of us to recognize something's amiss here. Because what we wanted before was dry land. The Red Sea, what are we going to do? Oh, dry land God has provided. Oh, we need to cross the Jordan River to get to the promised land, the land where God wants us to be. And they get to the promised land, and what do they face? More and more enemies and conflict and crisis. This is the first thing that happens when they cross over into Ai, remember? All of that is part of them saying, okay, so when we get here, is that all we needed, the dry land? So now watch what they say. Why did you flee? They personify the sea. The poet, the psalmist, personifies the sea, but now the people of Israel, as we're saying this in the psalm, they're saying it to the sea. So they're acting as if the sea can hear them and respond. But it's not for what they want to say to the sea. That's not the important part. The important part is what they want to say to the mountains and to the hills. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? You can take this sarcastically, like, what's wrong with you that you're doing this? But I think it's an invitation for us to think more deeply about where the power really lies. Because when you're facing a sea and there's no hope, the sea looks like it has all the power. And then the sea fled. It ran away. What was it running from? I mean, you would think the sea would be the scary thing. And the Jordan River would be the scary thing. Or the mountain would be the intimidating thing. But the mountain is quaking in the presence of something. And so in verses 5 and 6, what ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, like lambs? those of us, you know, who put our hope in crossing the Jordan or in the mountains of Jerusalem as a new home, and I just mean human beings, when we look for that thing in this world where we're finally going to arrive at the answer, the conclusion, the home we've always sought, I will finally enter into the promised land. Any of us who've done that, you would think that we would recognize where we should really find our hope and our home. Now, it's so apparent in all of the different things we experience in life. And the fact that in this poem, the question they ask is, what ails you? What's troubling you? What's making you ill? What's causing you to be weak? What is that? It points to the what now, you know, of the best things in this life. Oh, it's finally sunny. Oh, now we're too hot. You know, no, there's always something. It's, you know, you have an illness and you finally find the medicine that's going to help with, I'll use the allergies just to make it innocuous here, because all of us struggle with different things. Some people are struggling with serious diseases, and I'm not trying to pick on any of those. So I'll pick allergies, which can be severe. But in this case, I just mean, you know, allergies to pollen, the stuff that makes us miserable because our noses run. You finally find a medicine that helps with your allergies, only to find it makes you too sleepy to go outside and face the pollen. So might as well just stay inside to begin with. The point is, in this world, you would think we would finally realize that when you find what you thought was the answer, it also contains another problem. Now, this is the way it is with exercise. I read an article a long time ago, some health magazine of some kind or another. You can tell how bored I was in the moment. I have no idea what was going on that I would have bothered to read such a thing, but I did. And a big part of the point of it was that people who take care of themselves, they obviously end up with better health. They're doing all the stuff, eating the right food, exercising, all that kind of stuff. You know what normally knocks them off their game? What normally destroys their health in the end? That while they're exercising, they injure themselves. That's usually the thing, which I've seen a bunch of times. I ride a bike. I know what it is for somebody to fall off their bike and break their hip or break their jaw, as a friend of mine did, or whatever it is. And it's really difficult to recover from that, because then you don't get to exercise. Then you're out of the habit, and then you lose the momentum and all the stuff. That's what this world is like, and that's what we discover in the middle of this psalm. Oh, I thought that when the sea fled, everything was good. But I realized that it's not the sea and it's not the dry land. There must be something else, because however powerful the sea might be, I need to get it. If I can just get to the Red Sea, I'll be free from eating. No, you're not. The sea itself is a problem. Whatever else goes on with the sea or the river or the dry land, the mountain or the hill, something is greater than those. Now, we know in the psalm what it is. It's God. But I'm just making the point of this section in the psalm that the permanence God's people seek is not in the land where they seek it. That's not where they're going to find it. And they know that now. What they're about to describe as they sing this psalm together in verses 7 and 8 is where they do find that resolution. And it's sort of in the opposite direction than what you think. Because the direction the psalm has given us so far to think about in verses 1 and 2 is, oh, when we leave Egypt, we'll go to a better land. But now we see the land skittering like a goat or a lamb. That's not helpful. I need something permanent. I'm looking for something better. And so what we might think is, oh, well, the people of God, they're going to go settle in God. They're going to go settle in Yahweh. And that's true. He is our refuge. That's how he's described. And that's a beautiful sentiment, and it would make for a good other psalm. But it's not this psalm. The direction of this psalm is exactly the opposite as what we expect when we're reading verses 1 and 2. Let me explain what I mean. So in this case, it is true. God himself is the refuge for God's people. But as we read verses 7 and 8, we're going to come across the reality that God's people themselves not only are a refuge for God, they become his sanctuary, but they are the presence of God on earth, which is a fairly powerful statement. And it also gets a little tricky to us sometimes. So let me read these two verses. Verse 7, tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord. This is what we tremble at, the presence of the Lord. But then we're more specific, at the presence of the God of Jacob. Let me give you two ways to think about hearing that language. Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of our God, the God of Jacob, the people who are singing this psalm together. First of all, there's this repeated image throughout the Psalms, and it's clearly repeated throughout the Old Testament as well. I mean, I think of Zechariah, which I might read to you in a little bit if we have extra time. But the idea is that God rules on the mountain of Jerusalem, in Mount Zion, in, you know, where God has set up his temple. That's his throne. But his rule emanates outward from there over all the rest of the earth. And that's why, even though Mount Zion is not the highest mountain in all of the land of the world, it is described as the highest mountain in the world because its authority is over all the other images of authority in those lands. So in this case, we would read Sinai in, you know, they go on to Mount Sinai, and that's the mountain that's trembling in parallel to Zion or Jerusalem. Same kind of parallel that Paul creates in Galatians, by the way, just as a note to say it's not uncommon for this to happen, that you sort of obliquely pass back and forth between different images. That's just the nature of literature. Anyway, an example of this is in Psalm 50, where it says the mighty one, the very beginning of Psalm 50, the mighty one, God, Yahweh, speaks and summons the earth. From the rising of the sun, the east, to its setting in the west. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth. Our God comes. He doesn't keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire. You can hear him going back and forth between Jerusalem and Sinai, even there. Before him is a devouring fire. Around him, a mighty tempest. He calls to the heavens above and to the earth that he may judge his people. But in doing that, he says this, back in Psalm 50, verse 5, gather to me my faithful ones who made a covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, for God himself is judge. And you have that same kind of imagery in Psalm 46 and Psalm 47. It's in other places throughout the Old Testament that God is ruling from his mountain in Jerusalem as he rules from Sinai when he gives the commandments to Moses. But he rules over all the mountains and all of the earth. So that is a part of it. God himself is the refuge for his people, and he rules the earth from where he is in Jerusalem. But the other way to recognize this is this statement, tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord. We immediately run to the meaning of earth being the round globe that we all have in our office somewhere, right? So that's not the way earth is used for them. Earth is the land. That doesn't mean it's not also used to represent particular pieces of land or the whole of the occupied land of the world. It is used in all of those ways. It could be the garden, so that the mustard seed is, you know, produces the greatest bush of all the land. It could be that kind of thing. That's New Testament, obviously, I'm referring to, but I'm making the point. Or the land could be everywhere that anyone could possibly occupy in the world. So you can take it both ways in verse 7. Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord could simply mean tremble this land, O land, at the presence of the Lord. At the presence, in this case, the way I'm reading it right now, you could say it, the presence of your God, the presence of the God of Jacob, that he's saying it to Israel. So if the earth is the land of Israel, then the idea of Micah 4 is what is loosely being conveyed here. You know, it shall come to pass in this image, the people are described flowing to the Holy Land, flowing to the land of Israel. So the people become water. But it's the same idea of all the lands seeing God's rule in the land of Israel. So it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountains of the house of the Lord, Yahweh, shall be established as the highest of the mountains, and it shall be lifted up above the hills, and people shall flow to it. And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. There's something now new about them being the people of God that now they say, tremble at the presence of the Lord, tremble at the presence of the God of Jacob. And it's not a coincidence. Oh, when I say to you, tremble at the presence of the Lord, you might all as well also know he happens to be our God. It's more than that. And that's what's apparent when verse 8 is added on, this only direct reference to what happens between the Red Sea and the Jordan River, who turns the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a spring of water. And this is that opposite direction that I'm talking about. What we expected at the beginning of the psalm is they leave the place of strange speech and find a home in the land of Israel. They find a home in a different place. But in this case, when they leave the place of a strange speech where God was correcting them, chastising them, using the rod to bring them back to himself, when they leave the place of strange speech, they become the place where his presence is attended, where his presence is noticed, where his presence is heard and seen. So in verse 8, that's apparent because the desert, the place of scarcity, the desert becomes a place of abundance. When the people can see nothing but dry land, God provides water. Now, you may not have been listening earlier in the episode when I said it about when they were at the Red Sea, but this is a huge part of this psalm. When the people can see nothing but water, God provides dry land. When the people can see nothing but dry land, God provides water. That means what the people needed wasn't dry land, and what the people needed wasn't water. What they needed was their God. That's all. And when they have him, they have everything, no matter what they're seeing around them. Verse 8 couldn't be a more spectacular reminder of that lesson about the supremacy of God and the supremacy or ultimacy of our need for him. So when you step back into verse 7, it's not just that Yahweh is present, tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord. That statement by itself would be something to celebrate and a psalm worth writing. But in this psalm, it's not just that by itself. It's not just that God is present, even though that would be a cause of trembling. The point in this verse is not just that Yahweh has now claimed Jacob as his people. Oh, well, you don't belong to Egypt anymore. You belong to me now. And therefore, the nations should fear Jacob because God is their protector. That's there. That's a beautiful part of the Old Testament. It's part of what you remember when Rahab meets the spies. She says that. We heard what your God did in Egypt. We heard what he's done since then. And I want to be in service with you because we all realize we should fear your God. That is a part of what's going on. The statement at the end of the Passover passage in Exodus 14, when they literally institute the Passover for the first time, when they leave Egypt, the statement at the end of that chapter in Exodus 14 is this: thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. It is an important part of the story of the Passover, the story of the Exodus, that God has chosen them as his people, and therefore everyone else ought to fear them because he is present with them and he is going to protect them. But that's not the point in this psalm. It's present, but it's not the point. The point is this, that when the world encounters the people of God, it is encountering God, not because they became God. There's no confusion of creation with the Creator here. It's not because they become God, but because he is present in them. He's not just with them. He's not just a co-traveler. He is present with them. His Spirit indwells them, is the way we think of it now in the New Testament, with the Holy Spirit. But his presence with them is inextricable. They are now his sanctuary. They have become his dominion. And let's clarify what that term means, because this doesn't come without obligations on our part. The obligations are obvious. If the Holy Spirit lives in you, holiness should be what comes out of you. And if not, we're grieving, fighting against the very Spirit of God that's in us because we were desperate for him. So it's the same way with saying, they become his dominion. Israel is his dominion because they become, and we as his people, same thing, become the evident demarcation of his sovereignty. Understand what that means. In the second half of verse 2, Israel is his dominion. That means where Israel is, that's where Yahweh's sovereignty is on display. What does that mean? It means they obey him. It means they do what he says. Where do you find God's sovereignty? Where what he wants is what's happening. So the people of God become the dominion of God when they are obeying God. That's the whole point here. And that's what the world sees in Israel. That's why when they're not obeying, he sends them out to people of strange languages so they can learn again what it means to be obedient to him and then to be not just brought back to their land. That wouldn't have any meaning if the other part weren't attached. But to come back to the place where the world can see what it means for a people to be indwelt by God, to be indwelt by his Spirit so that when the world sees them, they see God. And to be lived in by a God they obey, so that in their activity, in their actions, in the way they treat one another and in the way they treat strangers, people see what God's presence in the world is supposed to look like. They see his dominion. So tremble, O earth, at the presence of Yahweh. That's why they tack this on, at the presence of the God of Jacob. Not just at the fact that there is a God of Jacob. You are, because you are seeing us, in the presence of the God of Jacob. This is what Jesus is communicating when in Matthew 25, he's not talking randomly about a variety of people being put in prison or a variety of people being hungry. He's talking about his children, his brothers and sisters, his disciples, his followers being treated this way. And this is what he says about it. When this happens with my people, this is what he says about it, Matthew 25. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. And the righteous, they come to him and they say, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and welcome you or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you? And the king will answer them and say, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of the least of these my brothers, these are his people, you did it to me. I know the language can be taken metaphorically, and I think it is. I think it is a very powerful metaphor, but it's a metaphor we're supposed to recognize without quibbling. We're supposed to take it as it is, that when we are acting as God's people, when his presence is obvious in us, then the world encounters God in his people. And when, so, you know, we would say this, and I'm driving to the close here, when his people attend to that presence, when they listen to his voice, when they don't have to be sent to a people of strange language in order to learn obedience again, when they're listening to his voice. So when his people attend to his presence, then they have everything. In the face of an overwhelming pursuing adversary, when the Egyptians are chasing them out of the land because they're leaving the land, they have an overwhelming flood, this dangerous thing, a flood, the waters on both sides of them that separate them from destruction. Exactly, by the way the flood delivers Noah from the destruction of the world around him. The water and land imagery in this poem, in this psalm, is just clearly saying, when we have Yahweh in the desert, they have water. In the sea, they have dry land. So let's pay attention to the presence of God in us, the presence of God in the world through us, and the reality that because he is present, everything else we need is already here. when we're paying attention to the presence of God, when we're paying attention to the words of God, then the world finds in us what they are seeking, and we find in Yahweh what we are seeking.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.